Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are looking at an idea that is so potent, so explosive, that if it were ever fully embraced, it would basically dissolve the museum system as we know it.
It would absolutely destabilize the art market.
And it would fundamentally rewire how you perceive every single person you see walking down the street.
We're diving into what our sources are calling the most radical extension of the concept of art since Joseph Boese's.
And I want to start with a question for you, the listener, right out of the gate. Just for a minute, forget about self-improvement, forget about becoming a better person. What if your very existence, your basic, unedited, morally complicated, moment-to-moment being, isn't just a person living a life, but is in itself a fully realized, constantly evolving masterpiece?
That is the ultimate challenge here. It's the core of the material we've gathered. We've looked at sources analyzing the whole conceptual framework around a late career assertion from Joseph Boese.
Right.
The idea that the human being itself should become the artwork. But our real focus today is on this revolutionary collective, the Joblin Factory.
Led by Jack Joblin.
Exactly. And they're the ones who took what was, for Boese, almost a whisper. And they turned it into a full-throated shout. They made it a radical axiom, a practical artistic method.
So our mission today is to really unpack the revolutionary character of their work.
Mm-hmm.
Because they perform this radical shift in focus. It's a move away from the human as an artist.
Yeah.
You know, a person who acts, who produces things.
To the human as art itself. The Menschensief.
The man in itself.
Yes, and that's an ontological statement. It's about what you are, not what you do for a living.
Okay, so to really get the gravity of this claim, we need to go back to its origin. The whole thing really pivots on one moment of incredible clarity from Boese.
A moment that has been seriously under-discussed. It was during a live TV talk in Austria in 1983. Someone pressed him about his famous hat, of all things.
And his answer was just seminal. It was almost a prophecy for everything the Joblin Factory would later build.
He said, "I myself am the artwork in this moment. That is, it should come to the point where the human being himself becomes the artwork." And our sources really stress this point that, quote, should have been a seismic event in art theory. It should have changed everything.
But it didn't.
It was largely ignored, or, you know, it got buried under his more famous, more institutionally palatable mantra, every human is an artist.
Which is much safer for the art market.
Much safer. The Joblin Factory's argument is that the art world just wasn't ready. They couldn't acknowledge that Boese was pointing to a fundamental destiny for humanity, one that just completely decentralizes creative authority.
And threatens the entire established order.
It posed a massive threat. So the Joblin Factory, they're the ones who picked up that dormant idea, and as you said, they pulled the pin.
Okay, so let's set the stage. Let's establish the historical runway that leads to this explosion. The idea of expanding art beyond just a painting or a sculpture, that's not new.
Not at all. It's a long, slow dissolution of the boundaries between life and art that's been happening for centuries.
You can go way, way back.
Absolutely. If you look at the Romantic period, you find someone like Novalis. He had this philosophical aspiration that every person should be an artist, that they should be shaping their world.
Kind of noble, abstract goal for self-cultivation.
Exactly, a high-minded ideal. But then the focus really shifts to the object.
And that's where Duchamp comes in.
The great practical provocation.
Very...
1913, Marcel Duchamp takes a urinal, a bottle rack, and calls it art. He creates the ready-mades.
And with that one move, the power is just ripped away from aesthetic skill, from craftsmanship.
And it's placed entirely in the conceptual framework of the artist's declaration. Art suddenly becomes a function of context, of choice, of an idea.
So after that conceptual leap, the artist's own body, their identity, starts to get pulled into the frame.
It does. By the 1960s, you have Ben Rottier literally signing himself, arguing that anything he could sign was art. So he's explicitly part of the artwork.
Which leads directly to Piero Manzoni.
Right. In 1961... with his sculpture Viventi, his living sculptures, he would sign people. Or, you know, just specific body parts. Temporarily designating them as art by the power of his signature.
He even had those Bassi Magiche, the magic bases.
Yes. A person could step onto this pedestal and for a moment they were an artwork. But the sign on the base always credited Manzoni. He was the artist.
The human was the material. The medium.
The human was being used as the material, exactly. The authority was still completely centralized with the artist.
And then you get Gilbert and George in 1969.
Declaring themselves the singing sculpture, making their own physical presence, their performance, the work itself.
So we see this clear, accelerating path. It's a movement toward pulling the artist, their actions, their chosen objects, all of it into the realm of art.
But here's where we hit a critical pivot. A figure that the Joblin Factory sources insist is absolutely essential, but is so often underestimated.
And that would be the German artist Tim Ulrichs.
Yes. While Manzoni was signing people who were still, you know, objects within a Manzoni work, Ulrichs, also in 1961, declared himself the first living artwork.
He beat a lot of the more famous body art and performance artists to the punch with that claim.
He did.
So what makes Ulrichs so pivotal in this lineage? Why does the Joblin Factory call him their unsung hero?
It wasn't just the self-declaration. It was the conceptual mechanism he used to pull the audience in with him. In his 1966 Selbstausstellung, his self-exhibition, he'd exhibit himself, sometimes in a glass case.
Okay.
But crucially, he often placed a simple mirror behind the living artwork.
A mirror? That's a fascinating detail.
It's the ultimate democratic pivot. It's a physical didactic intervention. It forces the viewer, the mitmensch, the fellow human being, to become both the observer and the observed at the same time.
So you look at Ulrichs, the self-proclaimed artwork, and you see your own reflection right behind him.
And you are immediately confronted with your own potential art subject status. It's the first step toward the Menschansicht.
So Manzoni signs the person, which maintains his control, his authorship.
Yes.
But Ulrichs's mirror is the real democratic move because it requires the viewer to self-declare their own status. It removes the artist's signature from the equation entirely.
That's the crucial difference. Our sources are clear. Almost everyone else we've mentioned, Duchamp, Manzoni, even Beuys, at least initially, they were focused on their own output or the conceptual framework or the social process.
No, but not on the ordinary person standing there looking at the art.
They weren't focused on making the mitmensch, the art subject itself, independent of any external anointing, except for Ulrichs and his mirror. He decentralized authority. He handed the responsibility, the decision, the authority to be both artist and art to the other person.
And that's why the Joblin Factory sees him as the true precursor to their revolution.
He's the one who opened the door.
Okay, that democratization of the subject is the necessary prerequisite. But this brings us back around to Beuys and what the sources call the linguistic trap in his most famous idea.
We have to talk about the potential limitation in Beuys' terminology. He famously championed the socialiplastic,
the social sculpture,
where our thoughts, our words, our actions all shape the world. It means everyone is an artist in the act of forming society. The focus is on collective, formative action.
But the word he and others, like his student Stücken, often used was Kunstwerk.
Yes, Kunstwerk, artwork. And the critique from the Joblin Factory's perspective is that the German suffix work implies something finished.
Like a piece of work, labor?
Exactly. It implies production, finality, something objective and concluded. The factory argues that if the human being is only seen as a Kunstwerk, you run into all these pitfalls.
Like what?
Well, for one, it objectifies the person, or it implies that you have to perform some kind of creative life performance to qualify as art. Or it suggests the art is only the material product, not the living, breathing, evolving subject.
It just carries too much institutional baggage.
It's far too much.
That is such a subtle but absolutely massive distinction. Beuys was ultimately reinforcing the every human is an artist idea. He was emphasizing participation.
That everyone can participate in making the social sculpture.
But the Joblin Factory says that's still not enough. It falls short of the radical ontological statement. Every human is art. Beuys's initial more radical idea got softened by his focus on the action of the artist.
And the Joblin Factory is here to, as they see it, correct that, to overturn the softening completely.
Okay, so let's really unpack this central thesis. Because this is where the Joblin Factory moves beyond just being a precursor and into genuinely revolutionary territory. They're taking this whole historical trajectory and pushing it past Beuys' framework into an absolute axiom.
The axiom is the absolute core of their identity. The Menschansicht, the man in itself, is art.
And what does that mean in practice?
It means that the status of art is inherent to human existence. It's independent of any external factor. It doesn't matter if you're a doctor, a farmer, an engineer. It doesn't matter what you do.
And this is the crucial part.
And crucially, it doesn't matter what your moral standard is. Art status is simply synonymous with being human.
That's a staggering claim.
Mm-hmm.
It completely removes any need to qualify for art status through skill or good actions or creativity.
Yeah.
It's like an unearned state of grace, conceptually speaking.
It's presented as an ontological axiom. It functions almost like a principle of communication, you know, similar to Paul Watzlawick's famous idea that one cannot not communicate.
Okay, I see that.
The Joblin Factory's revolutionary insight is the human cannot not be art. This is totally different from saying you cannot not create art. This is about your state of being. You are art simply because you exist.
And the immediate conceptual consequence of that axiom is their very deliberate rejection of the term Kunstwerk when talking about a person.
Absolutely. They insist on the concept of the art subject. As we just discussed, work implies a conclusion, a material result, even being, well, dead. The human is inherently living art, a constantly changing, evolving subject that can never be concluded or objectified. When you look at another person and you successfully recognize them as art, you're seeing something that is never just an object.
It's more than a human.
Exactly. It's never just the sum of how you're viewing them.
The revolutionary potential here is just immense.
Mm.
If this idea actually takes hold, the entire location of art shifts from the institution to the individual's perception.
That's it. This is what causes a revolution, because art is no longer something that's promised or granted or mediated by a gallery or a critic. Art is taken over by every person through their very existence.
You don't need a museum.
You just need a mirror or a window. A walk through a busy city becomes the equivalent of visiting the Louvre, provided you've developed that necessary internal mechanism for recognition.
And here's where it gets really, really interesting. Because a philosophical statement like that can be easily dismissed as just, you know, a nice thought. But the Joblin Factory developed these conceptual frameworks to actually underpin the idea, to give it structure and responsibility, to stop it from becoming what they call a Lear formal, an empty formula.
They established three major conceptual tools for this. And the first one is the most foundational extension of Bowie's work. They take his socioplastic and they create private plastic private sculpture.
Okay, so Bowie's social sculpture forms the external world through collective action. What's the interior discipline of private sculpture?
Private sculpture is the inner forming of your own thoughts, your spirit, your consciousness, by consciously recognizing others and yourself as art.
So the act is internal?
The act of internal recognition, that moment when you perceive someone as an autonomous art subject, that is the act of forming your own mind. This decision to hold the human subject in high esteem, regardless of their background, it shapes your own internal state. Your Halton.
Your inner stance or attitude.
Your attitude toward all people, yes.
So the private plastic is this continuous mental exercise, the internal discipline you need to maintain the axiom. How does that then connect back out to the external world, to social sculpture?
The connection is crucial, and they argue it's inevitable. A formed spirit, a private plastic, must shape society. That disciplined internal recognition inherently changes how you engage with the external world.
So the internal work becomes external action.
It has to. The whole goal of the private plastic is to establish what the sources call the perpetuum mobile of respect before the human. The Joblin Factory insists that this respect is built into the perception itself. It's not an add-on, and that prevents you from instrumentalizing or objectifying the subject.
So the goal isn't immediate world improvement.
The goal is not immediate world improvement, but world improvement is the inevitable side effect of a mind that's been disciplined in seeing inherent art.
This concept gets an immediate critical ethical weight when they start applying it to real-world dilemmas. I'm thinking of what the sources say about conflict.
Yes, this is where the private plastic, which is initially value-neutral in its ontological claim, becomes a profound ethical force.
And this brings us to their second radical tool, constructa, art rights, versus grindrecht, basic rights.
Right. The Joblin Factory uses the scenario of a soldier in a war, say, the conflict in Ukraine, as the ultimate ethical litmus test for this idea.
That sounds incredibly provocative.
Yeah.
Are they suggesting art rights should actually supersede the legal framework of basic rights?
The intention isn't to abolish legal protections. Your grundrechte, your basic rights, are vital legal shields.
Okay.
Rather, constructa, or art rights, mark a higher ethical demand that goes beyond mere legality. If a person is art, they must be treated with the highest non-instrumental respect.
And a soldier's orders are purely instrumental.
Exactly. The Joblin Factory argues that this recognition should force the soldier to prioritize the non-instrumental value of the human subject over societal demands like military orders. It creates an internal ethical block.
So it's an attempt to preempt law with ethics. The source kind of suggests art should function as a global moral pre-law.
In a sense, yes. The ethical component suggests that the human should never be viewed functionally or economically or instrumentally. You should view them as an autonomous art subject. And the recognition of that status inherently forbids actions that destroy the subject.
If I truly see you as art, I cannot shoot you.
That's the core of it. The framework is meant to encourage critical thinking and demand a continuous questioning of our assumptions about human value in every single decision we make.
This is also where they push back against any kind of moralism, isn't it?
So important. They insist that art status has to be ontologically neutral. If you start requiring the art person to be morally good or focused on world improvement, you're just replacing aesthetic critique with religious or moral guidance.
Which defeats the whole purpose of it being intrinsic and unearned.
It defeats the whole point. Art, they argue, is actually a more robust foundation for universal respect than morality is.
That distinction is crucial. Art as an ontological state versus morality as a criteria for action. And this brings us to their third conceptual tool, which is all about how this radical idea is meant to be processed and debated in public.
Discursive Kunst. Discourse of art.
So the art form is the discourse itself.
The primary medium is the democratic discourse. The continuous question at the heart of both your internal reflection and public debate is, why is this person art?
And that process of asking and debating is intentionally controversial. It's supposed to be messy.
It has to be. Controversy and debate are necessary to bring art back into society and stop it from becoming an empty platitude. The Joblin Factory knows this ideal will be exploited and shredded in public discussion.
But that's part of the process.
That's been the case with every powerful art idea forever. By centering the debate around the intrinsic value of the human, they are trying to move art from the very top of Maslow's hierarchy. You know, self-actualization, something only for the wealthy or secure. And move it down to a basic human need. Something as integral to daily social interaction as breathing or eating.
So the process itself, the argument, the questioning, the necessary failure to ever fully define or analyze the human art subject, that is the art.
That is the art. This democratization of the debate is their true revolutionary act against the passive consumption of institutionalized art.
Okay, the theoretical grounding is undeniably intense.
Mm.
But what makes the Joblin Factory so unique is their commitment to actually implementing this revolution.
Mm.
They challenge the established art market and institutions head on.
Well, if the theory says the human is art and art cannot be bought, then the next logical step has to be, how do we attack the market?
And that brings us to their radical anti-institutional toolkit.
If the whole concept is about absolute decentralization, the practice has to reflect that. So they developed the Kunstwahlgrundsätze.
The art election principles.
Yes. They model the act of recognizing a person as art on democratic elections. That recognition must be general, free, immediate, with no mediator equal, and potentially secret.
That's a total power shift. You decide who is art. Not a critic, not a museum, not a wealthy collector.
Exactly. It decentralizes authority completely, and they explicitly confront the art world's inability to integrate this. The sources point back to Barrys's own skepticism toward galleries. He said they only care about business.
So the factory asks the practical market-destroying questions.
The big ones. How do you exhibit people? Who sets the price for a human as art? The whole concept is designed for fundamental unmarketability. It inherently resists the market's predatory nature.
But that raises a critical point. If the art is unmarketable, what stops some perverse market consequence? Do they address the danger that some billionaire might start trying to buy or lease humans as art?
They absolutely did. And the answer lies in the haltung, in that inner stance. If you have truly formed your private plastic, then the objectification inherent in buying or selling, even if you call it art acquisition, is conceptually impossible.
The moment you treat a human as a thing for sale.
You failed the private plastic exercise. You aren't seeing the art subject. Your perception is flawed. The art status is inherent to existence, which cannot be purchased. It's not like a living sculpture signed by Manzoni.
So their strategy is to make the artwork so abundant, literally every person, that scarcity, and therefore profit, is just eliminated from the equation.
That's the plan.
Which brings us to their anti-object strategies.
Mm-hmm.
The physical things they create to carry this non-material idea. They're like reminders, conceptual levers.
Their memento multiples are crucial here. These are repeatable, accessible objects, t-shirts, postcards, these open-ended conceptual texts called ad books, and especially the mirror multiples.
They're used as a social technique.
They're mementos. Reminders. They are designed to carry the core idea, jeder Mensch ist Kunst, every human is art, into your everyday life. They intentionally counteract the high-cost exclusivity of traditional art. It's a cheap, reproducible tool for expanding consciousness.
And the most essential tool, conceptually linking all the way back to Tim Ulrichs, is the Spiegel, the mirror.
The mirror is the bridge to art self-understanding. It is their most powerful didactic intervention. When a factory member hands you a mirror, or you see yourself reflected in one of their displays, you are the viewer and the viewed, the artist and the subject.
All at once.
It forces that immediate, unavoidable realization of your own art subject status. It makes you part of the work without needing the signature or declaration of an external artist. The power of the Joblin Factory's mirror is that it democratizes the act of recognition.
It turns every viewer into a self-declared artwork.
Yes.
And then there's the most radical material they use in their exhibition work. Fleischeskunst, flesh art. Specifically, salmon art.
Uh-huh.
Why use perishable materials like fish or meat in a movement that's all about the eternal existential nature of the human as art?
This is arguably their most aggressive, visually provocative move, and it serves as a necessary visceral confrontation with mortality.
Also.
The Joblin Factory uses perishable dead flesh, totes flesh, to make the Gegenwart des lebendigen Fleisches, the presence of living flesh, the actual art conscience.
So the decaying fish acts as a spotlight on the living person standing next to it.
Precisely. It's a profound vanitas signal. It highlights temporality, embodiment, mortality. By confronting the viewer with decay, with smell, with the inevitable destruction of material form, they're emphasizing the urgency of appreciating the human subject as living, breathing, time-bound art right now.
The aesthetic shock of the decaying fish forces you to shift your attention back to the living viewer, to the living mitmensch.
The living human is beautiful because they are fleeting.
Is there a reason it's salmon, specifically? Any particular symbolism?
The sources suggest that the choice of salmon and other meats is about emphasizing the primal biological basis of our existence. It links the human subject, the ultimate art, back to the fragile embodied reality of flesh.
And sometimes they preserve it.
Sometimes they'll use lacquer or other techniques, which speaks to the aesthetic truth of the material itself, the beauty of decay and change, but only as a stark contrast to the dynamic living subject who is looking at it.
Their strategy isn't just about conceptual objects, though. It's a full-on institutional challenge. They use performance and non-sanctioned presence to force the revolution.
Correct. The Joblin Factory explicitly positions itself as the only true successor to Bose.
Why?
Because they believe they are the only ones taking his most radical statement seriously. Their public strategy hinges on these guerrilla vernissages at major institutional events like Documenta.
The huge international art exhibition in Kassel, Germany.
Every 5 years. And they were famously not invited to Documenta 13, 14, or 15.
But they showed up anyway.
It didn't matter that they weren't invited. They appeared on the streets of Kassel, distributing their multiples, selling shirts, carrying their salmon art objects, sometimes with deliberate references to Buzz, like the hat or a golden Dürer hair.
Was the goal there?
The goal was to ensure that the Documenta visitors, people who had paid a lot of money and traveled a long way to see institutional art themselves, experienced being the art. They democratized the exhibition space by forcing the realization that the most valuable art wasn't inside the expensive pavilion.
It was right there on the street.
You are the exhibition. You are the subject. That's the message.
They even went as far as threatening the continuity of Bowie's own legacy project, the 7,000 Eichen, the 7,000 Oaks. That seems almost sacrilegious.
It's a major institutional provocation, and it's designed to highlight the supremacy of their axiom. The factory discussed the concept of collecting 7,000 acorns and preparing individual trees from Bowie's project for potential topping down.
They weren't actually going to do it, were they?
It doesn't mean they want to destroy the trees. It's a conceptual measure. It's a way of demonstrating a radical approach to institutional continuity and discontinuity. They're questioning the sacred nature of even Bowie's most monumental works when you measure them against the ultimate artistic subject, the living human.
So if Bowie's trees are just an apparition relict, which we should get to, that detracts from the art subject, they have to be conceptually challenged.
They must be.
This shift, then, from the human as an artist focused on action to the human as art defined by existence, it has profound theoretical consequences. How does this reframe the entire history of art we already know? Like, what does it do to historical portraiture?
It fundamentally changes our relationship with every existing work of art that depicts a person. Traditional art, like the Mona Lisa, becomes what the Joblin factory calls an Erscheinungsrelikt, an apparition relic.
A relic of an appearance.
Exactly. It's not the person itself. It's just an image, a captured moment of a person who is seen as art by the artist, in this case, Leonardo da Vinci.
So in that reading, the Mona Lisa's famous smile.
It's rooted in the realization that she is being perceived as art by the artist. And she knows that the artist, who is also art, is reflecting that status back to her. The painting then turns that question on the contemporary viewer. I am art. What are you?
So every historical portrait, every bust, needs to be re-examined through this lens.
You have to ask, was that subject being seen as art? Or were they merely a representation of the artist's skill or the patron's wealth? It completely flips art history, turning the subject of the painting into the critical authority.
Okay, but if the human is, as the theory posits, infinitely complex and constantly changing, how can you even begin to apply aesthetic theory to Mentzsch? How do you analyze it?
That is the ultimate challenge, and it's maybe the most important scientific implication of their work. Kunstanalyse, or art analysis of a living human, is defined by them as a mammoth task.
It sounds impossible.
It's practically impossible with conventional, formal aesthetic methods. A simple biography is already too complex, too multi-layered, to allow for any kind of conclusive analysis of the human as art.
So the analysis has to fail.
Yes. And the theory suggests that the continuous, constantly failing investigation is still a valid Kunstanalyse. This forces science to develop new ways to describe this infinitely complex art form.
The inability to finalize the analysis is actually proof of the thesis.
The failure of the analysis is the success of the thesis. It proves the subject is truly art, an endless well of complexity that transcends objective measurement.
This framework also provides a fascinating new lens on education and knowledge production. It treats learning itself as an art action.
The principles of discursive Kunst, where art is debate and questioning, are applied to education through their P44P MOOCs, peer-for-peer massive open online courses.
Yeah.
Learning itself is conceptualized as an art action. Students become content producers and critics, not just passive consumers of information. Recognition and value are based on creating content, which is perfectly compatible with the core concept of decentralized authorship.
Knowledge production becomes a continuous critical performance.
That's right.
But despite this really profound theoretical underpinning, the radical nature of the thesis, every human is art, has to carry some inherent risks. I mean, it seems ripe for misunderstanding or co-option.
The most immediate threat is what they call the believability risk. The sources highlight the danger that the thesis just becomes a Lear formal.
An empty formula.
An empty formula. If everything is art without consequence, without a rigorous discourse or genuine responsibility, then the term loses all its utility and its critical edge.
And there's also the danger that this high-minded concept could be co-opted for moral guidance, that it could be pulled back toward being an exclusive religious or moral doctrine.
Absolutely. And they push back on that hard. They are very critical of using the concept for moral guidance, particularly criticizing the proximity to certain strands of anthroposophy, which can tend to moralize human action.
The Joblin Factory is insistent on value neutrality.
Completely. If you start requiring the art person to be morally good or to be focused on world improvement, you are just replacing aesthetic critique with religious guidance. Art status must be ontologically inherent, not earned through moral performance.
Which brings us right back to the internal mechanism of the private plastic.
It does. They argue that your thought can be free. It can even be selfish. You can be a secret misanthrope, as they put it, rather than a hypocritical anthroposoph. But the transformation of that thought into a private plastic inherently changes your stance toward other people.
Because the respect is built into the perception itself.
It prevents instrumentalization. The realization that the human is art is described as this treasure, one from which you can enrich yourself without making anyone else poorer, because the art is inexhaustible and it's universally accessible.
Let's end by returning to the source of this idea.
Yeah.
Joseph Beuys himself. Why did he never publicly push this most radical extension of his own thought in his final years? Was he really silent, or was it a calculated withdrawal?
The Joblin Factory argues that the Schweigen von Beuys, the silence of Beuys, is highly underrated and was possibly a calculated act of resistance.
How so?
Well, Beuys had already said that most artists don't want to fight for a new understanding of art, and that galleries only care about business. He may have simply realized that the art world, which is so dominated by finance and exhibition logistics, just wasn't equipped to deal with art that is not profitable.
Art that you can't own, that you can't collect.
Exactly. The revolution, in essence, was postponed because the art market preferred the comfortable status quo, an exclusive, profitable, material art object, over the democratized, unmarketable, existing art subject. His silence in this reading was his final, powerful critique of a market that would ultimately reject the most radical conclusion of his entire life's work.
So what we've analyzed today is a thorough, conceptual, and really aggressive revolutionary act. The Joplin Factory takes this expanded concept of art to its absolute logical conclusion.
They move from action-based social sculpture, where you are an artist-forming society,
to existence. The Joplin axiom, where the Menschenzeug is art.
And by establishing this axiom, they democratize art entirely. They relocate its power, not just from the gallery to the street, but from the institution to the individual's halton.
To their inner stance and perception. The private plastic.
It's an art movement that fights its own institutionalization. It uses guerrilla tactics, conceptual multiples, and the unavoidable reality of flesh and mortality, all to prove one single profound point. The art is already here.
The Joplin Factory showed us that they created an art movement designed to be unpurchasable and unexhibitable in any traditional sense. And by doing that, they protect its democratic and revolutionary character.
The revolution may very well be postponed. The art market certainly prefers the comfortable status quo. However, the true emancipation, as the Joplin Factory posits it, has to come from the individual, from the person who is capable of freeing their own artistic image from limiting viewpoints and from authorities.
That individual effort, the continuous creation of the private plastic, is the only way to actually achieve the democratization that Beuys only hinted at.
We learned today that a formed mind becomes a private plastic, and that this plastic has the power to initiate the perpetuum mobile of respect simply by altering our perception. So what stands out to you? Try this. Look in the mirror tomorrow morning. Can you truly recognize that plastic, that formed consciousness looking back at you as autonomous art, independent of your to-do list or your moral judgments? And if you can, how might that foundational perception change your interaction with the very next person you encounter? The art world might not be ready, but the artist is already in your head.